Next case, United States v. Mooney. Is the appellant prepared to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Major Alan Abrams, and along with Mr. Brian Meiser, I represent the appellant, Senior Airman Sean Mooney. Chief Judge Stuckey, may I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should reach the same conclusion it reached 22 years ago in United States v. Bramer and hold that Senior Airman Mooney's court-martial sentence ran concurrently with his district court sentence and, in fact, has already been completed. This court should rule in that way for one reason, and that's because Bramer makes clear that Articles 57 and 57A mean exactly what is apparent from a plain reading of their text. Now, both parties in this case, in their briefing, agree that Bramer is the key case that we're talking about here. And Bramer marked a clear distinction between what was and what is. In fact, on page 298 and 299 of this court's opinion, those were the very verbs that this court used. What was is the state of the law prior to Congress's adoption of Article 57A in the 1995 National Defense Authorization Act. But what is really what happens now that that rule has been adopted by Congress. And the rule flows in three steps. First, that under Article 57B, where a member sentenced to confinement runs from the date it is adjudged. That's just out of the plain reading and the plain language of the text of Article 57B. Second, to quote from Bramer, it may be deferred by the convening authority under Article 57A, subparagraph B, and that aligns with the earlier portion of Bramer where this court says Article 57A, subparagraph B, is the mechanism for a convening authority to do concurrent or consecutive sentences, and that's what the Department of Defense told Congress is what they wanted when they did that. And then third, if it's not deferred, then this sentence would run concurrently with any state sentences. Now, although this is not a state sentence in this case, the result should be the same, because it is the only result that is supported by the clear statutory language. This is a clear scheme that Congress provides, where Article 57B, subparagraph B, is a rule that applies in every single court-martial, every single one when we're dealing with a sentence to confinement.
It's not quite that simple, is it? Bramer, if you look at the tail end of Bramer says, well, based on these circumstances, the best we can say is a secretary of department could promulgate a reg which determined when they run. There was no clear rule of law which applied here, because all parties agree. All parties here agree the convening authority relied on 57E. He acted ultra vires. There's no reg. Well, here there's a reg. So where does that leave us?
Well, Your Honor, two things in response to that. First is, with regard to Bramer and that discussion there, that again, the point from remembering the part that you're looking at specifically, that's the part that's followed by, here's what the state of the law was, and that arises from this court's predecessor's decision in United States v. Bryant, which otherwise cast some doubt on what would otherwise be a plain textual reading. And second, in terms of the regulation that we have in this particular case, the regulation that we have in this case conflicts with the plain statutory language that we have. And so in our view, the regulation must yield to the statutory provision that we have. And that's because in Bramer, this court said, here's what we've got in terms of the framework going forward. What is the state of the law in light of Article 57A, subparagraph B, is that the sentence starts to run as soon as it's adjudged, and then absent an exception to that, it will have to run concurrently. And that, in fact, was the result that was reached in Bramer. So in terms of the regulation here.
So it's not just there has to be a regulation in place. The regulation has to track the statute.
It does, Your Honor. And that's something that works, say, with...
Curious that... We didn't make that point in Bramer.
I'm not sure I'm following your question there, Your Honor.
Well, we just said, well, you can promulgate a reg. There's nothing said about what the reg says. Simply, if there's a reg and it deals with this subject, then you follow the reg. And now we have icing on the cake, which is only if the reg tracks the statute.
Your Honor, I wouldn't characterize that as icing on the cake. I mean, this discussion about the regulation, and I don't mean to speak for the court with regard to the Bramer decision. I mean, I understand Senior Judge Cox wrote that decision. He could tell me if I'm reading it wrong, but
I sure really will.
Yes, Judge Sparks. So with regard to Bramer, though, that discussion about the regulation, again, as we read it, is really in reference to the state of the law post-Bryant. And, in fact, that tracks with the way that the Army Court of Criminal Appeals interpreted this framework as well. So when you look at the Willenbring case, which is cited in the government's brief, footnote 15 talks about these regulations, their continued validity is really called into question in a post-Bramer world. And I say that because in Willenbring, the facts of that case was that all of those facts were prior to Article 57E and Article 57A subparagraph B. But Article 57A subparagraph B, even as the Army Court recognizes, even with its reliance on Bramer, says, look, this Article 57A subparagraph B as adopted in 1995, that does change the game. That seems to be what Bramer says, and that's why we have the doubts about the continued validity of these regulations for certain circumstances. The regulations track when we're talking about Article 14B cases, and they do seem to track when we're talking about cases that would otherwise fall under the plain language of Article 57A subparagraph B. So when the prosecution is by, say, a state or a territory or a foreign country. But those are things that Congress specifically enumerated in Article 57A subparagraph B. I know the government...
What would be the rationale in Congress saying we are going to permit consecutive sentences if the state or foreign government is involved, but we are not going to permit consecutive sentences if the sovereign is the federal government?
Well, perhaps there's a policy reason for that, Judge Olson, in the sense that...
Can you think of one, though?
Sure, Judge Olson. So one potential reason is that the Congress did not anticipate the government using the resources to prosecute, the federal government prosecuting someone twice for same sort of facts and circumstances. Not that they're barred from doing it, but that's perhaps not a circumstance that they considered. That being said, even after Bramer, because this is, in our view, just a logical reading of how Bramer plays out, Congress had the authority to amend this statute. They have amended this statute, but they've really only amended it in terms of formatting, not in terms of substance. The rule remains the same, Bramer remains the same, and all of that is backed up by the DOD transmittal letter when Article 57A, subparagraph B, was sent over to Congress to begin with, which was that these sentences will run concurrently, absent giving convening authorities the power to do otherwise. And that power is essential here because convening authorities are not with limitless power. In fact, they have limited power, particularly in a case like Airman Mooney's, which is under the most recent amendments to Article 60. His power with regard to altering the sentence in his discretion was limited to basically just what was in the pretrial agreement. He could not suspend the sentence under Article 60. And so we're left to look for, well, what could he do? He could do very little other than look to see whether or not this fell under 14B, which the government in their brief at page 18 concedes that it does not. And so we're left to then look at, is this under Article 57A, subparagraph B? And it's also not. And so when we take that as backed up by Bramer and the way that the law is unchanged since then, the conclusion would have to be that Airman Mooney's sentence ran concurrently and has already run.
Isn't there some, I'm trying to think, isn't there some Latin phrase when the statutes include things, then it therefore it excludes others or something?
Expressio unius?
Something, yeah.
Yeah.
I did have to delve into canons of statutory construction. I thought that might come up. Yeah, there is that canon, Your Honor. The federal government was left out. We're left with really what's in the plain language here. There are other canons of construction, obviously. We can look at the purpose or intent of the statute.
And I think an argument can be made they knew exactly what they were doing, both of them the federal government.
Yes, Your Honor, that is our argument. But that said, we don't have exactly what's out there from the Department of Justice in terms of their thinking for this case. But also, when they prosecuted their case, they knew that Aaron Mooney could go to his court-martial and be a judge 0 days, 0 months, and 0 years of confinement. he was adjudged a sentence. That sentence was limited by the pretrial agreement. But at the same time, the pretrial agreement and all of the law that's really cited in this case is well and out there in front of the convening authority. But that this issue really came up and was brought out and fleshed out by the convening authority.
Let me ask you this. If confinement is deferred, and I really have no clue to answer this, if confinement is deferred under 57A or B, does the accused get paid during that period of deferment?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. In terms of...
If you deferred it and he wasn't in jail somewhere.
Yes, sir. I mean,
he would get paid while he was on active duty still, right?
Your Honor, at least in terms of the other portions, though, in terms of the other portions of his sentence that are judged, I'm pretty sure this would still be governed by automatic forfeitures and he likely would not be getting paid. So there's no financial windfall or anything to Airman Mooney in that sense. Absent any other further questions?
Yes, Major, I have a question. You may not know the answer to this, and that's okay to say you don't, and you probably don't. But what would be the U.S. Attorney's interest in having or ensuring that the accused plead guilty at his court-martial for the purpose of having a plea agreement in the federal court? I mean, is that discernible anywhere in the record? I'm not asking you to testify, but...
No, I appreciate that, Judge Parks. That's just not what's in the record before us. I mean, from the record that we have, that was part of the pretrial agreement. They were certainly aware of the two prosecutions as they were going on. It is...
Well, they often are aware, but I just wondered if it seems kind of interesting. I'm trying to understand what the rationale of the U.S. attorney would be in having the accused plead guilty at a court-martial later on.
And it's hard to say. I mean, what we do have in the record, Judge Sparks, is that all of the things that Airman Mooney was convicted of really came out from the very get-go of this case, which was brought out to the U.S. Attorney's Office. We get some of that from Ms. Jarman's testimony and her letter as well that was submitted by Airman Mooney and clemency. And then also there's a video recording of her interview, or her daughter's interview. So all these things were out there. In terms of what led to them being split up into two separate prosecutions, though, that's just not...
My question is actually more narrow than that, or my concern or interest. I won't say concern because that might be pejorative. But my interest is not in the fact that you have two separate prosecutions. That happens fairly often, at least as I recall. But my interest is this notion in the plea agreement for the U.S. attorney that the accused will plead guilty at his subsequent special or general court-martial. That's what I don't understand.
And, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that gives us a clear indication to answer that question other than it's there, it's a term that they had, and there was at least some overlap in terms of how these played out in that the U.S. Attorney's Office, as sentencing played out in that case, it took into consideration the underlying facts that were addressed in his court-martial. But I'm sorry, Judge Sparks, I don't have...
No apology necessary. Thank you.
I have a question. Am I correct that if this had happened in the opposite way, right, so that first he's tried at the court-martial, then the federal government says, hey, we'd like to have him for his trial, and then he went to the federal district court and got tried and got sentenced, right? That in that case, his sentence in the military court would be interrupted while he served his federal sentence, and then he would finish his military sentence when he came back?
It depends, Judge Ryan, and let me tell you, and let me explain why. So there's two different avenues that could go through. So let's...
Am I correct that that is a possibility?
Yes, Judge.
It could happen that way, and so when you've done explain the other way that it could happen, can you explain to me why if it happens in that direction, basically consecutive sentences are permitted, but if it happens in this direction, they're not? Because, I mean, doesn't that create a tension between 14B and 57B, which then permits, interstices for the regulation?
Just Ryan, let me just take up your question rather than my other avenue here. So in terms of what they could have done, yes, they could have done that in the way that you just described, where Article 14B would have come into play. That the Ellenson case was on the books, the Bryant case was on the books, the Bramer case was on the books, all of these articles were on the books. There's no secret in terms of how this could have played out, and the federal government could have pursued it in that route. They just didn't. And because of the plain reading of the text, that's what we're left with. Now, there's some of these issues that are talked.
Well, I mean, and I totally agree with plain reading of the text, but we're not reading any particular statute. In fact, right, we're reading them together.
No, and I agree with that, Judge Ryan. So in terms of,
when reading them together, we are left with text that perhaps isn't as plain as it seems, then what do we do?
Well, then, Your Honor.
And I'm not asking you to agree that we're in that situation. I'm just asking you, if we were, what would we do?
No, and I understand your hypothetical in that regard, Judge Ryan. So in terms of just where we are for that, I mean, yeah, it shouldn't be an absurd result. I mean, that's really where the statutes or the cases say we can go outside of that plain language of the text. But it's not an absurd result here. It's maybe a result that Congress perhaps wasn't aiming for, but that sort of goes back to, I think, Senior Judge Cox's question, where it's, well, they just could have done this in a different way. They just didn't hear. In terms of why this doesn't create a vacuum, it's because sort of that rationale for the vacuum appears to be what this court rejected in Bramer. There's the discussion in Bramer about there was this notion of historical preferences. There was this Air Force result that came up in Ellenson, which basically flipped Article 14B and had a completely opposite set of factual circumstances. But Bramer, at least as we read it, seems to reject that. And I see I'm almost out of time. Unless there are further questions, I'll be back for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Clayton O'Connor, along with Ms. Mary Ellen Payne. I represent the government in the case before you. Title V, United States Code, Section 301, Department of Defense Instruction 1327, 1325.7M, and Air Force Regulation 12530 give the convening authority the authority to run appellant's court-martial sentence.
Well, Title V, you're hanging a lot on Title V. I remember some other cases we had a few years ago, and they tried to hang this stuff on Title V, and we said, ixnay. Title V says nothing other than that. The heads of departments may promulgate regulations, period.
Correct.
Yeah.
In line with that, the Air Force and Department of Defense.
Well, and they can say anything they want because they're the heads of departments, leaving aside the problem that normally the head of the department, as opposed to the head of the military department, doesn't have anything to do with military justice. Secretary of the Air Force does that, not Secretary of Defense. And this is a DOD manual insofar as it's anything.
And an Army and Air Force regulation, yes.
Well, okay, subsumed thereby. Anyway.
And it's not that it can't be anything. It can't be arbitrary. It has to be consistent with the code as well. So there are limitations.
Well, yeah, it has to be consistent with the code.
Yes, Your
Honor. You agree with that?
100%.
Okay. Okay, now, let me ask you another question. Isn't it long-standing policy under the code to charge everything you've got in one ball of wax?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Then here we have that for which he was charged.
Yes.
And then you've got this other thing out there relating to a picture she sent him. And suddenly we don't charge that. We go whisper in the U.S. Attorney's ear. Why not?
I think that the District Court of Delaware had interest in prosecuting this case. I think they had the ability to prosecute this case and had a permissible means to enter their interests in prosecuting.
Well, that's dandy, but our policy is that we charge what there is to charge in one hunk.
And if
I'm sure they had to be. They don't like nasty pictures floating around Delaware.
But that's
not my question.
Well, at the same time, if the District Court of Delaware does enter itself with its own...
Well, it's not the District Court of Delaware. It's the U.S. Attorney for Delaware.
Yes, Your Honor. the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District Court of Delaware. Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
And if they enter themselves and prosecute the child pornography, whether or not they're discussing this with the military then would not be able to prosecute the appellant for
well,
that
no,
crime.
You got a rather substantial double jeopardy concern.
Agreed. And,
but, in
that view, the military then did prosecute all of the crimes that it could prosecute in one swipe.
Was there an agreement, memorandum of understanding between Delaware and the military installation or whatever about who got first dibs on prosecuting what? Does the record say that?
Your Honor, I would have to look further into it. I don't believe that the record explains one way or the other, but I'm happy to look further into that if that's of interest. But with this, Article 57, so again, these codes are presumptively permissive unless they're inconsistent with the code and submit that the defense has failed to show that they're inconsistent with the code. Article 57B provides a grant of authority for suspensions and deferrals of sentences that have the effect of tolling appellant's time in confinement. Article 57A provides an affirmative list of instances where a court-martial sentence can be deferred. That list is not exhaustive, and that list does not reference federal court sentences. Now, the defense has asked this court to read a prohibition into the statute that is simply not there. And it asked this court to read all of this patchwork of legislation as a comprehensive scheme such that the silence regarding federal court sentences...
Well, whether it's a patchwork or not, it doesn't seem to cover this situation, does it?
Precisely.
Federal civilian court conviction. You're convicted in U.S. District Court.
Right.
This reg or manual or whatever you want to call it does take account of certain circumstances, but it doesn't include that, does it?
It says any civil court.
It says any civil court.
Yes, Your Honor. And so it would cover foreign countries, it would cover states, and it would cover the U.S. Federal Code, similar to what Judge Ryan was speaking about earlier in regards to the effect of Article 14. Article 14 itself addresses any civil court. And in that instance, yes, a court-martial would need to be first, and then it would be a subsequent civil court trial. It does elucidate that this is not a comprehensive scheme.
What do we do about the fact that to the extent that the code says anything at all, in Article 14, it seems to suggest that it has to go in one order, and then in 57A, again, it leaves out this situation. So, I mean, under ordinary rules of statutory construction, wouldn't that be some evidence, at least, that there was an intent to leave it out?
I think
for whatever reason.
I think it highlights the silence in this issue, and that reading the intent into
well,
that
I mean,
would be reading
but
more.
There's also rules about, like, silence and when everything else is listed means that it was intended to be left out, right? That's how we interpret it.
And again,
so if we read that in conjunction, I don't mean to interrupt you, with Article 14, where, again, it's left out, where does that, quote-unquote, leave us?
Sure, and again, the intent for each statute then becomes relevant as to reading whether or not this is a comprehensive scheme or these are just patchworks of legislation. As we pointed out...
Well, whether it's a patchwork or a comprehensive scheme, if it leaves something out, it leaves it out.
Sure, and I think the court was talking earlier about the fancy Latin phrases. That means if it's left out, that there's words that can do that. I think, as the defense points out in Article 60, you see recent enactment where Congress intentionally went in and restricted the authority of a convening authority.
And we all know why.
and we do. And
go
that,
ahead.
That kind of language is not present in either Article 57B or in Article 57AB.
Oh, so, are you saying, well, that's a curious canon of construction, that if they didn't say they meant it, they didn't mean it? I don't know what you're saying. Are you saying that it's got to pop up in the report language or what?
Your Honor, our argument is simply that it's silent and that there is not a prohibition in the statute.
Okay, you need
so
a
that,
prohibition. It's not enough that the statute doesn't mention it.
And that reading a prohibition into the statute goes beyond the plain language of the statute and that it would be reading meaning into the statute beyond what it says. And insofar as it's beyond the plain language, it leaves open for this court's precedent in Bryant and in Brammer and the Supreme Court's precedent set by the Noy decision, as well as the Air Force regulations and Department of Defense instructions to control. Those regulations fill in the silence left in the statutes.
Major, I have a question for you. In your brief, you indicate that, or you state, I think, that the silence in the statute with regard to the federal laws, if you read that to preclude concurrent sentences, it would yield an absurd result. I think you do state. What did you mean by that?
Sure.
Because the reason why I ask is because couldn't Congress come along and say, hey, look, in every case, state, federal, foreign, all the sentences are won concurrently?
They could.
Well, what would be so absurd about that?
I don't think it would be absurd if they did that. I think when you look at...
But other than your statement, you didn't mean to imply that in your statement.
Correct. What I did mean is when you look at the Brammer decision, mm-hmm. and what it's talking about in regards to the letter of transmittal that highlights this role of the a statutory change regarding the Interstate Agreement on Detainers Act that would seem to affect how court-martials run consecutive or concurrent with state court sentences. Congress found a need to legislate to ensure that court-martial sentences could run still consecutive with their state court counterparts. In that, Article 57A(b) there is an authority ensuring consecutive sentences. In that you would read an authority affirmatively ensuring consecutive court sentences as a limitation to consecutive sentences. So again, reading a prohibition, that results the absurd result.
I understand.
In that, again, Congress didn't enter this field. Congress remained silent there. And again, consistent with the Brammer decision, the authority that the convening authority relied on is very significant. Had it not been for that authority, he would be without power to do that. But here, that regulation is in place, and it is consistent with the code, seen through the silence in the code regarding federal court sentences.
If the convening authority had wanted to disregard the SJA's advice, and he says 5 years is enough for this guy, I want the sentence to run concurrent, could he do that?
I actually think, given the regulation, he could not have done that. The regulation says that no court-martial sentences will run concurrent with any civil court sentence.
Well, isn't that regulation then inconsistent with the statute?
The statute gives the convening authority more power.
And isn't the statute, when it'll let 57A, when it enacted after this regulation?
Both. So it was certainly present before, and it's been promulgated since, and with the same language included in there. But yes, I think that the article in regards to state court sentences, in regards to sentences from foreign countries, Article 57A gives more discretion to the convening authority than the regulation does. It still doesn't discuss this one field regarding federal court sentences, particularly subsequent federal court sentences, because Article 14 would serve to address subsequent federal court sentences. 57A is just silent about prior federal court sentences. In addition, I want to discuss briefly what the government's position is in regarding the waiver, in that the defense did enter into a pretrial agreement, and in that it did enter into a provision to waive all waivable motions. I think consistent with this court's prior rulings regarding specifically Lee, the Supreme Court's decisions in Brochi, which the government cited, this is not a challenge to the jurisdiction of the court-martial. Given the court's decisions in Gladue and, again, Brochi, this is within the realm of an issue that appellant can waive. Even though it wasn't specifically articulated, the record makes clear that it was within the appellant's understanding that he would serve consecutive sentences. To the question Judge Barks asked earlier, I think that you see a reference in the plea agreement with the district court, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District Court of Delaware, shows that everyone was in lockstep about what was going to happen. That the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District Court of Delaware knew that this court-martial was going to take place and conditioned the plea agreement on that. I think when you see the record regarding the arguments that the defense made and the clemency arguments the defense made, the appellant also understood when he entered his plea agreement that he would be serving a consecutive sentence. That it wasn't...
So what's the waiver is actually him pleading guilty or his knowledge of what the issue was and proceeding to plead guilty, which you know what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it's based on both of those in addition to entering into a provision in his guilty plea to waive all motions that could be waived under the rules. And consistent with this court's decision in Gladue, entering a knowing enter into that type of provision in addition to just a guilty plea writ large, the appellant didn't need to articulate this specific issue in order to waive it. The appellant also wasn't surprised by what was happening. It's not as if the facts changed that undermined the appellant's understanding of what he was pleading guilty to.
Right, but how could he plead guilty to something that the convening authority had discretionary review over? In other words, wasn't it within the discretion of the convening authority whether or not to run them consecutively or not?
Well, I think you see a couple of things there. One, again, regarding the conversation that we were having with Judge Cox, according to this regulation, the convening authority actually has to run the sentences consecutive.
Well, wouldn't the SJA have taken that position when he advised the convening authority?
He doesn't seem
to have taken that position.
I agree that he didn't seem to take that position. He did, I believe, reference the regulation, though.
He did reference the regulation, but he didn't suggest in his recommendation to the convening authority that the accused had waived, did he? I don't recall seeing
that. You are correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
Right.
At the same time, again, you see in the record that it was in everyone's understanding, most significantly the appellant's understanding, that that sentence would be running consecutive. And so much so that the appellant made efforts to use that to his benefit, that he made efforts to plead for a decreased sentence as well as clemency to the convening authority in light of needing to run consecutive sentences. And I think that is what highlights appellant's understanding in entering the plea agreement.
Didn't he object in his 1106 matters to the convening to the SJA's recommendation?
Ultimately. After the plea agreement, when the SJA first made light of, raised this issue, appellant, after his initial submissions of clemency, then said, yes, I would like to object to that.
Okay.
In terms of waive all waivable motions, under 905A, or 905, yes, A, says that refers to motions as an application to the military judge for relief. So how would this work in the real world in terms of a military judge binding the hands of the convening authority?
Sure. I think there could have been a motion for appropriate relief for credit for time served. I think you see that with unlawful pretrial restraint or an Article 12 motion where an appellant asks for credit. And I think a similar motion could have been raised saying, I believe that this is against the rules, and I would like credit for every day of time I'm serving in federal court sentence. And I believe the military judge could have addressed that. Appellant could have also bargained with the convening authority to say, I don't think that I should be able to run these sentences consecutive or concurrently, or in that the appellant bargained for concurrent sentences in the pretrial agreement.
I thought you argued that the convening authority has no discretion under this regulation. If he has no discretion, how could you bargain for it?
No time. Correct. I think that they could have devised a way all the same to have no sentence.
Prove zero confinement.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Prove zero military confinement.
Correct, Your Honor. Just to say is that there were other ways of approaching this issue rather than making a perhaps strategic choice to use it at sentencing or clemency.
Isn't that something that the military judge should have been involved in a discussion on the record with the accused?
Again, I think that's the significance of the Gladue decision in looking at the appellant's understanding of what was going to happen, in that he entered knowingly and intelligently into a provision to waive all motions that could be waived, that more or less the military judge did cover that basis. They didn't have to articulate this one very specific issue.
Well, it sounds like it's something very important to the accused, would it not be?
Agreed. Similar to in the Gladue decision, I think that multiplicity would be, or double jeopardy concerns, or issues that the Supreme Court has referenced in the Broci decisions would also
right,
be
but this is a graver deprivation of liberty than he would have gotten under the, I mean, at the court-martial. So in other words, he has a lesser sentence under the court-martial than he got at the federal district court. Isn't it in his interest to ensure that they run concurrently so they don't have a longer sentence?
I believe that was a strategic choice that they could have made, yes.
And where would that, how are you discerning that from the record?
Is
and I'm not disputing, I'm just wanting to know.
Sure, and I'm not discerning anything from the record other than to show that it was the appellant's understanding that he would be serving consecutive sentences and entered into his plea agreement and waiver provision with that understanding.
Okay, well, I guess we can ask the defense counsel if that was his client's understanding. I understand why you might not know what his understanding
is. Just to reiterate, that's seen in the record through the arguments at sentencing as well as through the clemency arguments.
Okay.
So not just what the government hopes it to be, but that there is a record with a factual basis to assert that.
I understand.
I believe we provided it in our brief, and I know it's in the there's a brief portion of the sentencing argument that's in the joint appendix, as well as appellant's initial clemency letter that's in the appendix. And if there are no further questions, briefly surmise that we believe that the convening authority had the authority to run these sentences consecutive. That was based on this court's precedents and permissible regulations. Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
Your Honor, first I'd like to take up the government's argument that the statutory framework that we have doesn't cover this situation. I want to be very clear in terms of what our position is on that. Our position is that the statutory framework does cover this exact situation, just not in the way that the government would like it to, with all respect to their position. So Article 57B applies in every single case. Article 57A, subparagraph B, could have used the term civil, just like the Congress chose to do in Article 14, but they didn't. What we have here is a very conscious decision by Congress, based on advice by the Department of Defense, that these sentences would run concurrently, absent giving convening authorities the necessary authority. Congress gave that authority, but only for state and federal, or excuse me, state and federal prosecutions.
Ellenson and Framer's good law.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Ellenson and
Framer.
Well, in our view, Your Honor, Bramer is good law. Yeah, perhaps you're thinking of Bryant.
What about Bryant? Sorry.
Oh no, I understand, Judge Bryant. So, in terms of Ellenson and Bryant, we think that they are very limited at this point. I mean, the Bramer decision doesn't come out and say it for Ellenson, but I think the reading of Bramer is that Ellenson got it wrong. That seems to be the government's position in their brief at at page 18 of their brief, where they took Article 14 and just flipped it on their head. Based on Bramer, that wouldn't seem to fly. But Bramer also gives some credence to maybe why they did that, which is, well, we've got Bryant out there. And Bryant is, limited to its the concurrence that Chief Judge Quinn gives us, but in terms of its continuing validity, that maybe is its continuing validity. That said, the main holding of Bryant is really not the law anymore. What we have really in terms of this consecutive versus concurrent debate is Judge Ferguson's dissent is now the law. We can see that actually in Judge Sullivan's concurrence in Bramer, where it basically says the same thing in much shorter form that Judge Ferguson said in his dissent in Bryant. And that's concurring with, of course, the majority's opinion, where we had this unanimous decision in Bryant that the text means what it says and says what it means, and that's reinforced by the DOD transmittal letter. So in terms of their continuing validity, it is limited. And that's important. And we could see that sort of from the page 299 of Bramer as well, where it gives this recap of the circumstances, and it says that based on these circumstances, having gone through all of this survey of the law, the best we can... I'm sorry?
I didn't say sorry.
Based on these circumstances, the best we can say is absent the amendment to Article 57, the clearest rule of law was, and then it continues. And then two paragraphs down, it's the amendment to Article 57 makes it clear that it is a convening authority's decision to defer, and then runs right into the three-step framework that we have here. That's what the takeaway from Bramer, and that's what we're asking this court to hold. Briefly, if I could come back to Judge Olson, one of your questions had to do with kind of this split between DOD and Department of Justice. There's Appendix 3 in the manual for courts martial where there's a memorandum of understanding about that. But that's, I know neither of the parties brought that up, but that is something, that's the best I can say in terms of what's out there for that. And then lastly, I'll just say this isn't waived. There's no intentional relinquishment. In argument, you've got maybe wanting to dodge this issue because you do still have Ellenson on the books. You do still have Bryan on the books. We can dodge this issue if there's no adjudged confinement at the court-martial. I'd agree with the government. It's maybe not a model of clarity in terms of the initial round of clemency submissions in this case, but if there was any doubt about appellant's position here, it was clarified when the statute advocate raised this issue out front, and it was fully briefed before the convening authority. Before,
what's your view about waiver in terms of if do you agree that the record reflects that he understood that consecutive sentences were going to be imposed at the time that he entered into the pretrial agreement, or was the government mistaken?
Chief Justice Duque, I'm out of time. I see I'm out of time. May I answer the
question? Please answer the question.
Judge Ryan, in terms of, I don't think the record's clear on that. I think there's illusions about how things could have gone, but I think everything that, in terms of appellant's understanding of exactly how this would work, was clarified when we got to the step immediately before the last step at the trial level, which was action by the convening authority.
But I'm interested in what he believed, or what the record shows that he believed at the time that he entered into the pre-trial agreement.
And I apologize, Judge Ryan. So in terms of what was brought out on the record during the court-martial itself, it wasn't brought out by the judge's inquiry. That's not something that was fleshed out on the record explicitly. And in terms of how a waiver might apply just in any sort of guilty plea case or a waive all waivable motions provision, this is an error that we're saying occurred far after, whereas a waive all waivable motions and lease, as we're talking about antecedent errors as in errors that came before. Ultimately, one other thing that relates to Bryant in answering this question is in Bryant, we actually had the defense counsel bring up the issue of consecutive sentences. There was that issue about how should the members have been instructed. The presiding officer says, hey, it could be concurrent. Defense counsel says it could be consecutive. And then on appeal, they challenged, no, it actually couldn't have been consecutive. This court still took on the issue, or rather this court's predecessor did.
Right, but the government is saying that, and Chief Judge, The government is saying that this was actually your client's bargaining position. I think that's what they're saying.
Your Honor, that seems to be what they're saying. In our view, that's just not supported by the record. That wasn't fleshed out as part of the inquiry with the military judge. That's not explicitly part of the pretrial agreement. Bramer is on the books. The statutes are on the books. Everyone had an obligation to look at these cases. As Judge Ryan pointed out, perhaps with her question, there's a little bit of doubt that maybe stood in terms of how Ellenson may have impacted. Defense counsel tried to dodge that issue altogether by arguing, let's just not do confinement at all in this case because the federal government in the district court has already punished him, taking into account the circumstances addressed at the court-martial. So we just don't have the facts and the record that the government needs to make that argument of waiver really come to fruition. Unless there are any further questions, thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Court is in recess pending further order of the court.
All rise. Court stands in recess until further order of the court.